This podcast is a Tucker Media production. For more information, head to tuckermedia.com.au.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Media Mates podcast. My name's Ralph Tucker. Each week I'll chat to somebody I've met from my career in and around the media industry. All of them have such great stories to tell. I'm not Michael Parkinson or Andrew Denton, but I do enjoy chatting to interesting media people about where they've been, where they're headed next, and everything else in between. My guest today is Clinton Maynard from 2UE. Clinton has spent the best part of 20 years working at the radio station, firstly as a cadet journalist, then as a newsreader and reporter, then moving on to become the news director, and finally the content director. We chat about where his love of radio came from, the ups and downs of 2UE over the years, and the drought-breaking win by his beloved Cronulla Sharks in the NRL Premiership. There's not too many more passionate people about radio than Clinton, so I really hope you enjoy our chat. Clinton Maynard, welcome to the Media Mates podcast.
It's an honour to be on the show. I'm a big listener.
Good to know. Now, you're currently with 2UE Talking Lifestyle. That's just come into play?
Correct.
How are you feeling?
Great. It's look, it's a controversial move for the station within the industry, but this is the future for the greatest brand in Australian radio. Now, I'm biased because I've spent most of my career at 2UE. I've been at 2UE for 19 years with 1 year away. So I'm a 2UE man through and through. But 2UE has not been sustainable in its previous form for more than a decade. And having worked in senior management with the network and with 2UE, I know that better than anyone else. 2UE had to change, and it had to change to a sustainable format that's going to work from a business point of view and hopefully a listener point of view as well. And that's what 2UE Talking Lifestyle is all about.
And what's the general vibe been like within the building, having moved from your Greenwich headquarters to now Pyrmont, where 2GB is located?
Really good. And I honestly say it's been good because it's been a long time coming. The staff at 2UE are a damn resilient bunch. We've been through a lot of highs over the years, but we've been through plenty of lows as well. And since the merger, there's been a hell of a lot of anticipation about what the future would bring for 2UE. So we merged with Macquarie Radio, our owner's Fairfax Radio. It was now April 2015. That was the official day one of the merger. The merger had been announced in the December before that. So we'd been living with this for a long, long time. Now, when the merger was announced and then actually came into being as a new company, Macquarie Media, as the new company was known, and that's 54.9% owned by Fairfax, the old 2UE owners, and the rest owned by the Macquarie side, the 2UE business remained at Greenwich, our traditional home. And little by little, parts of what were at Greenwich moved to Pyrmont. And that was the other parts of the business, like syndication and satellite music and the other operations we had. But 2UE, the radio, the actual broadcasters, were left at Greenwich up until the end of June. And that means for months and months on end, we were this little part of a company all in our lonesome. And for the staff, you know, Ralph, that was actually really hard because we were still doing what we've done for years, a full news talk format.
Yep.
Our newsroom had merged with 2GB's newsroom and was now based in Pyrmont. And to be honest, the service from them was still great, but they physically weren't in the building with us. Our sales force, and I think people in program underestimate how critical that is to the vibrancy of a radio station. Yep. Our entire sales team had merged with 2GB's and were based at Pyrmont. Our promotions team, our traffic department, all the various departments make up a radio station, all gone to Pyrmont. And here's little old broadcasting 2UE in four wonderful studios at Greenwich, but nothing else.
And was it a weird feeling?
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was just bizarre because we knew we were part of this bigger operation, but in some ways we felt a little left out of the whole thing because we were still over at Greenwich and we were still doing our thing, essentially competing head-on with 2GB as we have for 90 years, but left alone over there. So for the staff, there'd been an enormous amount of anticipation about what was going to happen. So when we actually moved, there actually wasn't this fear of, oh, hang on, we're going to move in with our old enemies, 2GB. There actually wasn't. Because it had dragged out for so long, there was actually – it got to the point where we were desperate to get over here.
I was going to say it'd be more like a comforting feeling knowing the fact that there were
more people over here.
It was, and we wanted to be reunited with like a promotions department. You know, say if you're doing a program and a prize has gone missing, and a listener complains they haven't been sent a prize, you used to yell out down the corridor, "Hey, where's their CD?" Now we couldn't do that for months. It was great to do that, and the process wasn't easy, mind you, and still isn't. It's been pretty challenging from the physical location here at Pyrmont, but I actually had the pleasure of doing the final show. The honour of doing the final show from Greenwich in late June. George Moore was meant to do it with Paul B. Kidd, and George was sick that day, so I filled in with Paul B. And it was a sad moment, shutting down the microphone at the independent solo TUE, but it was something which we really wanted in the end.
Someone who loves radio as much as you do, that wouldn't have been something that was lost on you.
It was massive. You know, in some ways, I guess I'm part of the furniture at TUE. Been here for a long time, and I'm the final sort of senior program director of the old format of 2UE, and to be able to do the final program from that Greenwich studio, it meant a hell of a lot. Now, it wasn't by design. It was simply because George Moore was sick. I was meant to be doing the weekend afternoon program that day and do it from Pyrmont.
So you're going to be the ushering in rather than the ushering out.
And Paul B., insisted that I host, we've got a good relationship, and Paul insisted that if George was going to be sick, he really wanted me to do the show with him. And it's our number one show. It sounds a bit weird for people who don't follow radio closely, but George and Paul on the weekends is the number one weekend radio program, 6 to 12 in Sydney, despite the fact 2UE is not exactly at the top of the charts.
No.
so we treat it really carefully, and Paul insisted that I do the show, and my boss said, okay, you do it. So Trevor Long then stepped in for me on the Saturday afternoon show. So Trev did the first show from Pyrmont. Bit of a homecoming for Trev, being a former assistant PD he himself, and then I did the last show from Greenwich. It was one of those moments.
Let's go back in time then to where it all began. You sort of mentioned there that you'd spent 19 years of your career at 2UE.
Yeah, something like that.
Was radio always it for you? Was that the career path that was always going to be the one for you?
Oh, you're going right back now, Ralph, but when I was in primary school, I wanted to be a radio announcer. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a radio announcer. Or an architect.
Right.
And I thought, I'm going to have to be an architect. No one can be a radio announcer. It's too hard. And I started to do public speaking in junior high school. And my teachers were great. They just really encouraged me. They said, you can be anything you want to be. And I just went to a public high school. I went to Janelli Boys High School, pretty rough and tumble public school.
Yep.
But the teachers there really encouraged me to follow my dreams. So I did. But, why was I interested in the first place? I'm a football fanatic. And we're recording this 2 days after my beloved Sharks won the grand final.
We'll touch on that.
But I'm a football fanatic. And as a little kid, probably as a 10-year-old, it would have been a 10-year-old in the mid-80s, I discovered that they did football on the radio. And I discovered these commentators on 2GB, where we're now sitting at Pyrmont, Hollywood and Zorba.
It was the greatest, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. I could not believe – I'd watch football on TV. I could not believe how entertaining these blokes were on the radio calling football, and I just became obsessed with them. And from listening to Hollywood and Zorba, I then listened to 2GB, and I discovered people like Brian Wilshere. All the conspiracy theories and all, as a 10-year-old, I just lapped it up. Even listening to John Pierce, the late, great John Pierce, on Saturday night.
Same.
I used to love his program on a Saturday night. But it was all because of football, and that got me interested in radio. And then Hollywood and Zorba, they signed a deal and went to 2KY.
That's right, I remember.
And they went to 2KY, and because they went to KY, they couldn't do football on a Saturday because of the races. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. What's going on here? So I twiddled the dial, and I discovered Ray Hadley. And I discovered Ray Hadley in the continuous call team.
I think there was a lot of people like that grew up with Hollywood and Zorba, and then when they made that ill-fated move to 2KY – for what essentially was a big deal for Peter Peters back in the day.
He was doing breakfast as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. But it actually killed their football audience. And then what happened was they were still quite big on Sundays, but then Sunday racing came in. So it was impactful on not only the Saturday call, but the Sunday call as well.
I think it's a really good lesson for radio programmers that you need to get things right, not just in your breakfast shift. We all know breakfast is the most important shift of the day in a radio station, but you actually need to get them right across the day, because you can pull in listeners to your station by attracting them to an off-Broadway program. So I'd been there listening to Hollywood and Zorba, and therefore was a bit of a 2GB listener in my, 12, as a 12-year-old. My parents did not listen to talk radio at all. They were 2WS listeners back in those days. So 2WS was in the car and in the house, not 2UE or 2GB.
Well, I have a similar story. My dad was very much 2UW back in the day.
So. Magic 11. So I then discovered Ray Hadley in the continuous call team. And I was captivated by Ray's style of broadcasting, the way he did football. And then because I then didn't go back to 2KY on the Sunday. I was there for the Saturday for Ray, and I was there then for the Sunday. Now, because of that, I then discovered Stan Zamanek on 2UE. And at that point, Stan was doing 7 till 10.
Right.
And Philip Adams followed Stan. You could not get two men poles apart as broadcasters. No. One, a wild, screaming lefty, and then Stan doing what Stan did. And I heard Stan and thought, oh, my God, how does this guy get away with this on radio? And this is around sort of 1990-ish, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
When Stan really started.
Replaced, like, Arch Tambakis.
Yeah, Arch got the sack at one point, I think, from 2UE. And so there I went from listening to Ray in the football commentary and the continuous call to listening to Stan. So the big headline acts 2UE in the early 90s, they were Alan Jones and John Laws.
Yes.
Two of the greatest broadcasters this country's seen. But I wasn't attracted to 2UE because of them. It was Ray Hadley, continuous call team, and Stan Zamanek.
Yeah.
But from that, I then heard Breakfast. I then heard Alan Jones. I then heard John Laws. And even as a teenager, I then became a committed 2UE listener.
And then you would have been Brian Bury and then John Stanley because it was just such a staple diet of announcers like year in, year out for such a long time.
It was just – it was awesome. And listening to that as then a teenager and as a younger man in university, all I wanted to do was work at 2UE. That's, you know, 2UE was the powerhouse of Australian radio. And all I wanted to do was work at 2UE.
That's fine to have those dreams. How did you join the dots to actually get there?
Yeah, it's not easy, is it?
No.
As you know, Ralph, it's I wanted to be in radio when I was in high school. My parents thought, you're crazy. I had a bit of a flair for economics in high school, so they really encouraged me to go to university and do an economics degree. So I did that.
We have similar paths on so many different ways because I did 3-unit economics at in year 12 as well, and I was destined for that path as well. And I was never going to get the marks to get to Charles Sturt. So I ended up going Macleay College, then work experience. So I'm interested in your path.
It's funny you talk about Charles Sturt, and I've heard you talk to many people in the business about Charles Sturt. Charles Sturt was never on my radar. I didn't even know about it. Nobody had ever told me about Charles Sturt. What I'd heard about was this communications degree at UTS, which I think Justin Kelly, Rosa, had done, but I didn't know Rosa at that point. And my careers advisor at high school had said, oh, yeah, UTS. The TER for that degree was 98.
Yes.
You're talking medicine territory. So I worked my ring out in high school. I went so hard in year 12 to try and get those results. I didn't get them. You know, I think I'm a reasonably intelligent guy. And I'm a damn hard worker. But I got 89 or 90 in the HSC. I didn't get 98, and I couldn't go to UTS. So I went to Wollongong Uni, and I did economics, and I was bored out of my brain, even though I actually do love economics, but I was bored. So I started doing a little bit of community radio at the same time.
Where was that?
Station called 2SSRFM, which is the Sutherland Shire community.
Yeah.
Sound of the Shire,
99.7. Now, where was that based at that time?
At that point, it was a little house in Grey Street in Sutherland.
Yes.
And then they moved to the grounds of the hospital.
That's right.
Sutherland Hospital, Canberra. Yes. And I was actually involved in the renovation efforts to try to build those studios.
Wow.
So I did a little course there and started up a program called Saturday Night Rock Spot.
Knowing you, you will have tapes.
There'll be tapes somewhere of Saturday Night Rock Spot. And I actually know there's a kid who works for me here at TUE, Cameron, and he now works at 2SSR as well. And I just think about how, I shouldn't say easy, but how professional they can now make community radio sound because they've got modern technology. They've got digital edit. Anyone can edit digitally on a laptop at home.
Yes.
I used to sit there at home on a Saturday prepping my show before I go to the studio with, you know, a double-deck cassette machine trying to make my own imaging for my countdown, recording from one cassette tape to another cassette tape and, you know, sounding pretty dodgy and thinking this is the bee's nest.
I can only imagine.
And then I got my hands on a cart.
Not a cart machine, an actual cart.
Because we had cart machines at 2SSR, and I was so happy I had a cart. I could then record all my own imaging pieces on the one cart. And I think guys these days who work in any form of level of radio, you know, the world's your oyster because of digital technology. But back in those days, it was awesome. I stole the cart from 2Day. So while I was doing that, so I was at university doing economics, being bored by that. I was at 2SSR doing Saturday Night Rock Spot, working at Woolies at Carring Bar, and I got a gig on the Today FM community switchboard.
That was big back in the day.
It was massive. I had a mate who worked there on the community switchboard, like as a sort of part-time manager, and he got me the gig. When I say gig, voluntary. You weren't paid, but I'd go in there every Sunday afternoon, and I even missed a Sharks grand final qualifier in the mid-90s. That's how dedicated I was to working
against Manly
in radio. Yeah, the Cronulla Manly match. I think that's the one where David Peachy had a shocker, or can't remember now, because I was actually working. But that's how, I mean, I'm a bit obsessed with the Sharks, and that's probably an indication of how desperate I was to work in radio. So I'd go in there every Sunday, drive to Crow's Nest from the Shire, which was a pretty long way back as a kid, and it was great because I could hang around jocks in a real radio station, and there were some blokes in there like Steve Carline, who was one of their weekend disc jockeys, who sort of took me under his wing and showed me the ropes. And funny thing was, you know, Steve years later ended up producing me at 2UE. Ronnie Sparks, who's just an, you know, absolute legend. Ronnie Sparks made my first demo tape. And I'm really proud of that moment that someone like Ronnie Sparks, who I just idolized as a radio legend, would take the time to help out this 19-year-old kid who wanted to work in radio and, you know, made a demo tape with me. So that was really important because all that led me to getting into afters. I don't know, you've spoken a lot about your podcasts about Charles Sturt Uni. I wasn't even aware of Charles Sturt Uni or doing journalism, but I was aware of afters. So when I missed out on getting to UTS, afters was then on the radar. And they do a lot now, obviously, in the full-time space with graduate diplomas and stuff like that. But they had a full-time course and they took 12 people a year on that course. And it was hugely competitive to get in. But to get in, you had to demonstrate, you know, you're passionate about it, but you had to demonstrate that you'd done voluntary work. And I'd done the radio with 2SSR FM, and I'd done Today FM as well, and that somehow got me in. And that was, I guess, the pathway.
And what was the best thing about that particular course?
I wasn't going to university in Wollongong listening to lectures about stuff I had no interest in. Every day, they were out at North Ryde at that point, actually based on the Macquarie Uni campus. And every day I'd get to hang out with like-minded people who were radio lovers, and all day we get to talk about radio. We get to learn radio. And I've got so much appreciation for what afters did. Afters is structured very differently to other courses. Back in those days, and it's similar today, they would bring in people from the industry to be their lecturers. So there was a lady by the name of Lucien Joy, who's former ABC, who ran it. But then the lecturers were all these former TUE people, 2GB people, people from the FM world. So people like Jason Morrison, who's an afters graduate, I think himself, he'd come out and he'd lecture about radio news and reporting. And it was fantastic. And at the end of that, the whole course is designed to getting you a job in radio. In fact, I've interviewed somebody from afters this morning about work here. They set you up on a work attachment and they sent me down to 2EC in Bega.
Ooh, what was that like?
That was an eye-opener. 1997, so it was the year of Super League, and I recall being sitting in my Bega hotel room at the pub there watching Super League matches. It was a weird competition.
Mm.
But I went down to Bega and I did news, and I did a night show that was voice-tracked. It wasn't live.
Oh, right. So you record in the afternoon and then after the news.
But I was only down there for 2 weeks, and the first week I thought, oh, geez, this is my future, working in a country radio station. Don't know about this. But, you know, when you're getting into radio back in those days, it's sort of changed a bit now, you knew to get your start, you had to start in the bush. And I was, you know, prepared to do it. But after the first week, I'm thinking, oh, I don't know if I like this. By the second week, working at 2EC in Bega, I was desperate for a gig. And by the end of that week, they offered me a job in Bega.
What changed for you?
I called 2UE by chance. A year beforehand, they'd advertised for cadetships, for cadets. And they, a year beforehand, put three cadets on at once. Zoe Alabone, Nino Tissarero, and Gina Trahan.
I love the fact that you remember all of these people.
Yeah, and well, I worked with two of them for years, Gina and Zoe. Anyway, I applied for the gig, and Julie Flynn, who was the news director at the time, interviewed me, and she said, with Sandy Aloisi, and said, oh, look, we really like your enthusiasm, but we want you to finish your education, because I would have quit uni to go and do that. they sort of said, oh, you know, get in contact with us when you finish. And I, at the time, probably thought, oh, yeah, whatever. When I finished afters, when I was offered the job at 2EC, I thought, oh, look, I'll just ring TUE just in case. And I called them, and Julie Flynn says, actually, as a matter of fact, there might be something. And I got a job from that, and it was a newsroom cadetship, which, you know, now is a bit of a rarity.
What are they?
Yeah. Look, basically, it was a reason to pay me nothing. when I say nothing, yeah, I don't. I think I was paid $19,000 a year to work in the newsroom. And the job initially was, it wasn't on air, it was learning the ropes of the TUE newsroom.
Which at that stage was just full superstars, of wall-to-wall legends. Mate,
you walked into that radio station, and this was 176 Pacific Highway, Greenwich. And look, I'm biased because I work for Macquarie Media. I think the 2GB lineup of at the moment is one of the most powerful lineups of all time. But I don't know if anything will ever top the 2UE of the late 90s in terms of an all-star news talk lineup. It was just magnificent. And the newsroom matched it. So we had Alan Jones on breakfast, John Laws on mornings. At that point, Brian Bury on afternoons, John Stanley in Drive, the great Peter Bosley doing Sports Today, and Stan Zamanek on nights, and then Ray Hadley running sport and running football. It was just awesome. And then the newsroom was equally as good. You had the great Jimmy Angel as the breakfast newsreader. You then had Sandy Aloisi as the main mornings reader. And then you had these just amazing reporters who I just respect so much. People like Ian Craven, who a lot of people might not know Craves, but yeah, he worked for UE for years, and no one could cover a funeral better than Craves. Packed to overflowing was his description of the chapels at funerals. Never forget that. Lance Northey covering courts, who's now senior within the New South Wales government. Chris Marr was the state political reporter, and I think still one of the best police reporters has ever been. Justin Kelly is the police reporter, and I learnt so much from someone like Rosa. And you had the Julie Flynn running the show, and the legend that is Murray Olds as our dedicated Olympic Games reporter. This was obviously in the lead up to 2000, so this was 97. Yeah. Buzzard had covered Atlanta in 96, and he had been the news director.
Yes.
They appointed Julie Flynn news director, and then they moved Buzzard into this full-time Olympics reporter role because Sydney 2000 was such a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a daily job, and Buzzard had the job of covering it daily. And I learned so much from those guys. They're just, I mean, I'm still in awe of the people I've been able to work with. Even behind the scenes, someone like, probably somebody I've learnt so much from in my radio career is known to our listeners on TUE, and he's recently moved to 2GB, Stuart Bocking. Stuart Bocking was the breakfast news editor.
Yeah.
And he took me under his wing. And it's funny how things go. I ended up being Stuart's boss for several years, but Stuart taught me radio news.
So what was that like? It must have been just like being a kid in a candy shop.
It was, you know, the first job actually was back before a company that some of our listeners may know of, ATN, ran traffic, the Australian Traffic Network.
Yeah.
Each radio station put together its own traffic reports. Now, 2UE did it better than anyone because we were number one. We had money. We had a helicopter.
Yes,
we had a traffic helicopter. And one of my first jobs was actually in breakfast to be the, you know, this sort of thing doesn't happen anymore, you don't have the staff, to be the communicator between the studio and the traffic helicopter. So we had guys up in the traffic helicopter who'd vary from day to day, but Ian Wallace did it at one point.
Yeah.
Grant Goldman did it at one point. All these guys up in the helicopter. And I'd be feeding them information about traffic. So I'd be learning about the basis of just information dissemination by giving the guys in the chopper information.
Yeah.
But then I'd run back into the newsrooms in a different part of the building and then help Bock on the breakfast shift. And I'd be learning my craft in terms of how to write a news story. What is a news story? How to write. And at that point, I wasn't on air. I wasn't reading news bulletins. And it took me 6 months to get to that point, which I still remember vividly.
Yes. Well, Janine Moore shared the story about when you got your first gig on reading overnights, did after that to Sandy Aloisi, which was bordering a huge bunch of flowers.
No, it was funny. I've employed a lot of people over the years now in news and in programming. And when you're employing people for the overnight shift, it's almost like these days, it's like, you're asking them, is there any chance you might be able to start on the overnight shift? Back in those days, it wasn't like that at all. I was desperate to get on the overnight shift because that was going to be my break. And let me tell you, reading news on 2UE overnights in the 90s on 2UE was a bloody big deal because it's so powerful. And our news bulletins went to every market in the country.
Oh.
So, you know, when I finally was allowed to read, and I had to do lots of demo tapes, and the great Breno, John Brennan, who you know, I'm fortunate to still be in contact with, he with Sandy, listened to those tapes and said, yes, he's right to go. And it took 6 months. And, you know, I was so happy. Yeah, I got a bunch of hours. Yeah, I was happy.
Take me to that point where you had to read your first book on air. What was that like?
I can't remember it, Ralph. Actually,
were you nervous?
Yeah, I would have been. I would have been hugely nervous. I think I might have stuffed up. I think I may have. I can't remember, but I've got a vague recollection that I may have, instead of pressing my microphone button, played a grab.
Played a grab straight off the bat?
Yeah, I think I may have played a grab.
Wow.
I can't remember.
I don't think you would have had. You've got tapes of that one.
No, probably not. But, you know, I did those mid-dawn shifts for years.
Yeah.
To start, as you always all do. And you learn. You know, that's, you're there in this newsroom by yourself.
Because nobody would have been moving, right? Like you mentioned the great sort of lineup and people were in their specific jobs. And unless somebody left, there was no way you could actually maneuver yourself into another slot.
And I was really lucky in some respects. When I came through those really early days in the CW newsroom for me, we had what was called the pool, and we were the pool of junior journalists. And we had if you look at it now, a damn good pool. The people who I was in the pool with were, you mentioned Janine Moore, Toosey, I know her as Toosey. Yep. Janine Toos was a maiden name. Erin Maher, who's now the news director here at 2GB, she joined roughly the same time as me, but a little more senior than me at the time. Josh Murray, our listeners probably don't recognise his name anymore, but I actually think he was one of the best reporters I've come across and could have been a really big name in TV news reporting or radio news reporting had he stuck with it, but he ended up going to government. But he rose so high in government, he was chief of staff to Maurice Yemmer, Premier at one point. He's now senior in a corporate company. Kieran Gilbert, now of Sky News fame, was in the pool. And, you know, KG and Josh the three of us used to learn from each other. It was a really big deal because there wasn't a lot of movement with your Jim Angels. And then when Steve Blander came across from WS, you had Blander, who, you know, we all know is the greatest reader of all time.
Yeah.
He was reading Monday to Friday Breakfast and Jimmy was reading Saturday and Sunday Breakfast.
And then you had someone like Bronwyn Martin who was doing, you know, Afternoons or Drive.
You know, another, Bronnie, I hope you don't hear this, but because I talk to her on the radio sometimes from the Transport Management Centre. But I think she's one of the best female newsreaders we've had in recent years, it was the last 20 years, and now she's doing, you know, transport relations for the government, which I think, to be honest, a bit of a waste. She should be on air. She should be on radio because she was a great newsreader. It was just, you know, Emma Tonkin, who people may not know of these days, was our nighttime newsreader. She now works, she's had triplets who are probably grown up now, but she works in the ABC in Newcastle. We just had an all-star, powerful newsroom, and you learnt so much. And
you think it's a shame that and I don't want to sort of belittle the newsreaders of today, but just that quality, that's just that authority that was there in those days because it was considered such an esteemed job to do that. And it was such a skill that you had to refine and work on and you built up your years of credibility to become that person and you were known as the newsreader on 2UE or 2GB back in the day as well because they obviously had quite a few well-known newsreaders as well. So the gloss has sort of gone off a little bit, I think.
Look, it has, Ralph, but despite being, you know, long-term 2UE, and I'm a very sentimental person, to be honest, but I'm also a realist. Media and the business world has just changed so much in the last decade. It had to change. And the choice that's now out there for the media-consuming public is so wide and varied.
Yep.
Back when I started, the internet was text-based. You know, you didn't have the options to consume media that you do now. So, yeah, it was always going to change. The revenue that radio stations made back in those days was always going to fall when the net took off and different ways of consuming media and content. So, yeah, we can look back in those days and think, wow, those newsrooms were wonderful, and they were. But there was nowhere near the competition there is now for eyeballs and for ears that there is now.
So you made it through there. You got the reading start and then, you know, obviously as things evolve and people move on and as you sort of said, things change. You made your real name as a reporter. How did you find that, like going out into on the road, as we call it?
Yeah, it was one of the best things I ever did was becoming the police reporter at 2UE. And I know, you know, through your series, you've spoken to a few former police reporters at 2UE. And it's back in those days, and it's to an extent still, it was regarded as the premium job in the 2UE newsroom, but the one that you had to work the damn hardest.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I did that, it's probably around 2001, 2002. And I did it for almost 12 months. And you're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But it means you go to all the big stories. And that was fantastic. That's how I learned my craft. And these days I'm an on-air presenter, a broadcaster in programming, but I learned to be an on-air broadcaster because of being a reporter. So I'd come from a newsroom where your craft is writing three pars and cutting up a grab, and then presenting those three pars and grab as a bulletin and crafting a bulletin. There's a craft in that. There's another craft that goes into being an on-the-road reporter, and that's the ability to tell a story live, unscripted, ad-libbed, and hold an audience doing that. And that's what I guess led me down to the ultimate path. What I do these days is as a general broadcaster, being able to communicate on radio without announcing, without reading.
That's so take me through that skill. Oh. What is it that makes that? Who taught you that? How did you adapt to becoming a police reporter? How did you put those phrasings together while you're on the road with no time to do a cross to program and or quite often live into a news bulletin?
Yes, probably people like Justin Kelly. I looked at what they would do and learn from them. I actually reckon it's quite simple. Use your eyes. Describe what's around you. So if you're at the scene of a fire or a robbery, take in what's around you, look at what's around you, and then get on air and describe it. And you know, the best reporters deliver the best descriptions of a live scene, and that's probably what I enjoyed the most. And that's my grounding, I guess. And that's, I suppose, why I have that ability to be able to speak off the top of my head. In the police round, I lasted just under a year with 2UE because I was then offered a job by Channel 7 doing the same thing, being their police reporter. Yep. And I actually turned them down a few times. And then I went to 7 to do the same job but on television. And to be honest, I found it really difficult because TV is, again, another step from radio in that you, as a police reporter, you have more contact with the victims of crime. You probably, because you're broadcasting pictures as well, you need the pictures of those terrible sites. So you become more engaged in it. I found it really hard and I didn't enjoy it, to be honest. And I think Channel 7 and I came to a mutual agreement to part ways after a year. And had we not done that, I would have said to them after my year doing police reporting with them, can I move off that round? Can I go into general reporting? Because I was finding the crime aspect just not too harrowing, but just difficult. The funny thing was, it was pretty rare that I was beaten on a story, but you'd still get in trouble. For instance, you'd go and do a house fire and you didn't have a particular shot of a burnt out bedroom or something and you get your ass kicked, which is understandable. That's the way it works. Yeah, but yeah. I hated that pressure. I hated that pressure that I didn't have a shot of this. It's like, who cares? What's coming out of my mouth?
I'm
still telling the story. And I think I knew that, they knew that. So, you know, it came to an end after a year. But, you know, my highlight of my short TV career was when I got to be a radio reporter. And I was the first reporter on the scene of the Waterfall train disaster.
Right.
Because that's, you know, I live in the Shire. And Sunrise was just a new program on Channel 7, and I was first on there. And so I just grabbed the phone, and I did phone crosses with Sunrise as a radio reporter. And then we finally got crews mobilised, and I was then doing TV crosses throughout the day. But I'm crossing into the 11 a.m. news and the 4:30 news, which they just started because of the Iraq war. And I was able to be a radio reporter then on camera, but I didn't have to follow scripts. I could just tell that, and that was, you know, I really – sounds bad, enjoyed that day. You know, people lost their life. But I as a reporter, that was my short-lived TV career, that was probably my highlight. Funny thing was, I think Channel 7 won a Logie for their Waterfall coverage, but I'd left by that point. And I was watching TV that night with my wife.
Cut from the speeches?
Well, yeah, we thought, I don't usually watch the Logies. And we're flicking around the channels, and Cass says to me, oh, yeah, stop on here, they're going to do the news report category. So we did. All of a sudden, I heard my voice, and there they're playing my package, and it won the Logie. So, yeah, I'm a Logie winner.
You're a Logie winner. Yeah. You can add that to the resume, mate.
Look, when you know, they punted me and I sort of punted them at the end of 1 year. It was the day before I moved into my first home and took my first holiday, which was a bit rough. And they didn't punt me. They said, look, you've been our police reporter, but you've got no future as a reporter. However, we think you're a good journalist. We'd like you to move to the midnight to dawn shift producing.
No, thanks.
So I kindly said, look, I'll have a couple of days to think about that. I then spoke to a few radio contacts and I got back to them pretty quickly and said, I think I might have a future as a reporter. Made the finals of the Walkleys reporting the year after, and I left. Very happy to leave.
Did that TV experience, did it sort of give you a bit of more of a hardened edge?
It was actually did me a lot of good.
Yeah.
I came back. I was really lucky. I had good mates working at both GB and UE. Justin Kelly at 2GB offered me a job. And 2GB by that point had then become the number one station in the city. And Greg Burns was then, he was news director at 2UE. Sandy Aloisi had been news director when I left and they changed. No, actually, maybe Sandy was still there, but they created a job for me at UE, which I was blown away by that they would do that. My salary had to halve from what I was on at Channel 7, and it was very attractive to potentially come over to 2GB because they were number one. Great respect for Rosa, but I went back to 2UE, and they created a job where I worked. I've got a, you know, as I said, Ralph, a passion for sport, and they created this job where I would work 5:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday and Sunday reading sports bulletins, and I'd never done sport and radio before, and then 2 days in the newsroom doing news. So I accepted that job, and the idea was that I'd do it until a
somebody else left
until
and you were able to sort of
and I think it's a good, you know, I think that's actually a good lesson for a lot of people in radio. You know, having listened to some of your podcasts and listening to some of the younger journos, you hear their upward progression where they just keep going up and up and up and up and up in their career. Careers aren't like that.
Sometimes you've got to take a sideward step or a backward step to move forward.
Absolutely. And I've done it a few times in my career, even recently. And that I decided to take a massive pay cut from what I was on at 7. I could have stayed at 7 and kept being paid good money to work the overnight shift. I just couldn't do it. I decided to take a backward step financially, but not just take a backward step, work weekends doing sport, which I was interested in anyway.
Yeah.
I'd come from being the crime reporter on Channel 7, which is a pretty prestigious role, to then reading sports news updates on 2UE. And 2UE was not number one by that point.
No.
But I wanted to do it because I could then see a pathway. So I did it, and I ended up only doing it for 6 months. I really enjoyed it, actually. But I did it for 6 months, and then the state political reporter's role came up at 2UE. I think Ella Callan was doing it at the time.
Yeah.
I think she might have been poached by 7.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. And so I moved into that job.
That was a job where you ended up working with a lot of people that, like, I know, well, a lot of people within the industry. So you started working with Anthony Clark and Leanne Lincoln and Rachel Stevens.
I worked with Clarkie before at 2UE.
Yes, of course.
But Clarkie was then doing stuff for, well, firstly GB, but then Nova.
Yes.
My time at State Parliament covering politics for 2UE is probably up there with the job of my career so far. Loved it. I was based at State Parliament in my own little studio down there. And it was next door to 2UE. When I went down there, Zoe Allibone was the 2UE, the 2GB political reporter. And Zoe and I had a good relationship. And then she moved on and Punchy, Rachel Stevens, became their political reporter. And we got a natural love of politics, so we got to cover politics every day. And I like state politics. Unlike federal politics, what I think state politics has over federal is there's more direct relevance to everyday people in terms of you talking about trains. You're talking about hospitals, things that people actually need every day.
That people care about and have a genuine interest in.
And it was a really colourful time in politics. Bob Carr was the Premier, and going along to a Bob Carr press conference and event was an entertaining experience.
Oh, he's still one of the greats of all time. Yeah. Anyone who had anything to do with media or journalism in those days, whether it be working in a radio station, TV station, or whatever, I still laugh at the fact that he used to ring in and, you know, okay, look, I spent most of my career working in sport, but if there was nobody around, so I'd take the grabs, and he'd ring in and he'd count himself into grabs.
Yeah, he was amazing. Or immediately got hold of one once as well.
Or you'd ask him like a tip for the grand final coming up this weekend, and all of a sudden you'd just hear, meep, 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 and he'd hang up.
Like, I really used to enjoy it because I became known as in the press gallery as the one who might ask the slightly left of centre question, the slightly silly question, but I'd do it to try to get a response from him. And he'd give you a response. And he was actually, I interviewed him on air on 2UE Drive about 2 months ago about a foreign relations issue as a former foreign minister. And I said to him, oh, Mr. Carr, you might not recall this, but do you remember talking to me in a press conference? You gave me this response and I kept it on tape, and it's where he mocks me and he takes the piss out of me. And I replayed it to him on air. And he got a really good laugh out of it. And then you had all the instability of those final years of Labor in power, where they were knifing leaders left, right, and centre. And we went from Bob Carr to Morris Yemma to Nathan Rees, and then the opposition ranks, you had John Brogdon, who I really liked.
He should have been premier, that guy.
Yeah, he would have been great.
He should have been.
You know, unfortunately, he then had his own issues that I covered at the time. But, look, that was a great job, and it was a great crew. And what I learnt there was, again, live work. Steve Price was our drive announcer at the time.
Yep.
And Pricey, who I now work with here at TGB, he allowed me a lot of latitude in doing a daily segment with him. So instead of me just reporting the news, he actually allowed me to editorialise. And he actually asked me for my opinions about state political issues, and I really enjoyed it. And it sort of gave me a grounding in editorial, which, you know, as anyone who works in news talk radio, that's the bread and butter. If you're working in a commercial news talk station and you're going to sit on the fence, you're not going to get anywhere. I like to express an opinion. And Pricey allowed me to start doing that, which I really enjoyed. So that was great. But the other aspect of doing that state political round is I was the most experienced and the senior reporter at 2UE.
Yeah.
And it meant that all the big, big stories, Burnsy would assign to me. So outside of state politics. So I got a lot of big stories. And I think there was one year I went overseas 4 times on news stories. And to be honest, in radio, it's almost unheard of these days that you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sort of stuff. But I was able to cover things like the arrest of the Bali Nine, Chappelle Corby's sentencing. You know, I was standing in the courtroom when Chappelle Corby's given 20 years live on the John Laws Show. I covered an execution in Singapore. Not nice stuff.
No.
The Boxing Day tsunami across Indonesia and Thailand. Not overseas, but the Beaconsfield mine disaster. I got to witness these like really historic events.
Tell me about those things and what the process is for covering those things. They're highly emotive. They're nationwide, international stories of significance.
Yeah.
You pretty much get one shot at that stuff, so you don't want to stuff it up.
Yeah.
How do you bring that all to life and put it out there, knowing that you have to get so many facts and so much information right for the listening audience?
I think, again, it's what I've mentioned before. It's using your eyes. I mean, firstly, as a journalist, you've got to have your eyes open the whole time anyway, in that you've got to be exposed to the news cycle 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. You've got to know what's going on. You've got to know what the issues are in politics. You've got to know what the issues are at a state level. That then gives you the basis to then go when you go on a major story to fill it out. You then use your eyes. So often when you go on one of those really big stories, same with TV reporters, same with radio reporters, newspaper reporters, you're given no notice. Some of those trips to Bali, I would be driving into work and Burnsy would call me and say, hey, we want to send you to Bali. Can you get on a flight at 4 o'clock that afternoon or 2 o'clock or whatever? You'd scramble. So there was minimal time to go and research the story you're doing. So you'd get on the plane, and back in those days, there was no internet on planes, so you couldn't do any research on the plane. You'd start to write a few notes maybe, but you had to hit the ground. So I have this vivid recollection of covering the arrest of the Bali Nine. They'd been arrested maybe a day or so before I arrived in Bali. I'd never been to Bali before. I've been there a lot since. I got off the plane, foreign country, no idea how to speak the language, and somehow communicated to a taxi driver that I needed to get to the police station. And so drove in the back of this taxi with all my luggage, and you try to travel light when you're a reporter, but still had luggage with me, straight to what they call Polda Bali, which is the police headquarters, and straight into a chasing of some sort of lawyer around the courtyard of the police station. And I vividly recall being on the radio, probably on the Steve Price show again, doing a cross within 10 minutes of me arriving at that police station in Bali, having come directly from the airport. No accommodation organised, nothing, just a suitcase.
How important was it for you to have somebody like Steve Price that was willing to give you, like you said before, really that latitude and allow you to probably collect your thoughts on the run, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, it's funny, I did a cross with Pricey. Now that 2UE and 2GB are one, we actually use talent from both stations. I did a cross on the Sharks with Pricey only 2 nights ago. I reckon I owe a lot to Pricey. Because he gave me the opportunity to do things like that on his program. He's very happy to hand over airtime to reporters. And that allowed me to develop those skills to tell a story. But others, all the broadcasters I've worked with over the years have really been of that of that ilk. But, you know, going back to what you're saying and how you then cover that story, you use your eyes. You pick up the feeling of what's happening around you. So it might be describing the clothes that, say, Renee Lawrence, who was one of those Bali Nine drug runners, was wearing. That can then give paint a picture as to how tough she's been doing it since she was arrested. You paint a picture of what you see in front of you. And therefore, if you don't have all the facts at that point, because you've literally got a report on something as soon as you arrive, you can fill out the facts within the news bulletin itself back in the office. But nothing can replace you providing that description of what you see. And I guess that's been my sort of trademark.
Going back to a story like Beaconsfield, where legendary it was story. Just the great unknown for yeah. such a long time, but then within the story there was the tragedy element that occurred down there when the 60 Minutes reporter Richard Carlton died yep. while covering the story. How do you adapt in that situation yeah. where you – it must have been bizarre because, again, Leanne Lincoln was there, Brett Zarb was there, Anthony Clark was there. And
Cork, very weak. He left halfway through. Look, that was just, again, one of those stories. When Beaconsfield happened, again, I had no notice that I'd be going down there to Tasmania. Hadn't been to Tasmania since I was a kid. Burnsy just said, get on a flight, fly down to Tasmania, hire a car and drive out there. And, again, you're doing the same thing. You touch down probably Launceston Airport, hire a car and drive to Beaconsfield, this little tiny little town that no one had ever heard of before. And you drive straight there, you pull up outside, you pull out your phone, you do file a report straight away. It was 2 weeks and I slept for 2 weeks in my car, in the hire car, outside the gates of the Beaconsfield mine.
This is radio, people. This is the glamour.
Yeah, really glamorous. And people would say, this was in May, and Tasmania in May is not warm. People would say, why did you sleep in your car? Well, all the accommodation in that area was back at Launceston, which was about a half an hour, 40-minute drive. 2UE, along with 2GB, offer a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week news service. So I couldn't afford to go back to accommodation in Launceston and then miss the chance of them that the two miners suddenly being released and walking out. So the likes of your Anthony Clarks, Paul Murray, all mates of mine, they would go back to Launceston because they were working for FM networks.
Yes, that's
didn't
right.
matter. Didn't matter if they missed it.
Yeah.
You know, as it turned out, we did get a tip after the 2 weeks of when it was going to happen, and I did book a night's accommodation then, and then it happened the next morning very, very early. And it was good because there was a Sharks game on that night, and it meant I could go back to the accommodation.
I love the recurring Sharks theme throughout this whole thing of your life obsessed. And your career.
I'm a bit obsessed. And then I drove back to Launceston Beaconsfield that morning with everyone else because we knew we actually had the tip that it was likely to happen. So that gave me my first night. But, yeah, look, it was one of those extraordinary Australian stories, wasn't it? Something you'll never forget. It was, I mean, it turned into a bit of a media circus, mind you, with all those caravans and, you know, the Naomi Robsons and all that having their hair and makeup trailers and all that. But on the other side of it, you had people like me and Zabi was doing it, Brett Zabi, a bit from GB. He was sleeping in his car as well.
Yeah.
We had to be there. And that's what it's about. But, you know, I never forget those times. I miss them.
What's it like being in the courtroom when Schapelle Corby's being sentenced?
Yeah. It's a moment in time, isn't it? It was. I hadn't been to Bali to cover her arrest. I'd been there for Bali 9, and then Bench Corby happened about 2 months after Bali 9 had been arrested, her sentence, and she got 20 years. And I was on the phone live to John Laws. I think TV reporters are probably getting their head around it now because there are so many TV news bulletins out. There's a lot more demand on their time. But it's been like that for radio forever because we have hourly bulletins, half-hourly
bulletins. Yeah.
But not just that. When you work for a station like 2UE, we're the head of a big network. So even though 2UE has not been number one for a long time, we have 3AW in Melbourne, 4BC in Brisbane, 6PR Perth, 5AA Adelaide, and then other stations as well that take our news services.
All want a piece of your time.
All of them wanted to do crosses with you constantly. Everyone wants a piece of you. So you're constantly on the phone doing these crosses. And it's not hard. I actually don't think radio reporting is that hard, to be honest. It's just telling.
It's just talking.
It's just talking, and it's telling people what's going on using your eyes and the basic information and getting the facts right. But to be constantly doing it all day. You get better at your story because you're repeating it so often, all these different outlets. But I vividly recall it was my birthday and lying on the grass of that courtroom complex afterwards, just absolutely spent, exhaustion, and thinking, wow, I've just spent whatever birthday it was. It might have been about 28, 29, thinking, wow, I've just covered the sentencing of Chappelle Corby. And, you know, fortunately, when you go and do those stories, then you can go back because of the time zone, the way the time zones work. You could actually enjoy the evening a little bit because it was very late at night in Australia by that time. So you'd already done your filing. Go back to my hotel room, and then Origin was on that night, and Brett Camorley threw that pass that was intercepted by Matty Bowen in State of Origin and cost him the game in the series. And I co-hosted with Noddy a few weeks back, and I reminded him of that pass. These are the everything links back to footy, bro.
I know.
Yeah.
I can see.
All the big moments
I
in my life. Oh. Forget that Corby was sentenced to 20 years. It was the Brett Camorley pass.
Yeah, it was all about the Brett Camorley pass. Now, moving to management, how did that suit you? Because as I've sort of discussed with a few people, mostly female reporters, they seem to want to come to your office and cry after they leave. So you must have something going for you in the management stakes.
Yeah. So I moved into management. It's about 10 years ago now. So I've been in management for about 10 years. So I was doing this. I was state political reporter for 2UE, and the senior correspondent, you might say, being sent to all these big stories. Anyway, I've been married for a couple of years, and you'll know this as a dad. My wife wanted to start a family. And I don't know if people realise that radio is not particularly well paid, and radio news is in particular not well paid. And Cass wanted to have a baby, and I started doing the sums, and I figured out I couldn't afford it. Just couldn't have. And we live pretty frugal lives anyway, but we've got a Sydney mortgage in the Shire, and I did the sums and thought, I can't afford to start a family. I'm going to have to look for something else. And I almost got to the point of starting to sniff out TV again because TV pays better.
Mm.
And anyway, there was a bit of movement within TV's management structure. And Greg Burns, Sandy Aloisi had resigned. And, you know, there's a few very influential people in my career, and Sandy was one of them as a long-time news director and then a program director, and she'd give me, and while I was doing the reporting, I started as an on-air presenter as well, which is a big part of what I'm about, and Sandy had given me those breaks. Anyway, she was leaving as program director, and the word was Greg Burns, who was news director, was going to be appointed program director, and it was a bit of a path at TUE.
I was going to say, what is it about the fact that there was that succession of news directors that became program directors?
In the end, there was three of us. Sandy became from news director to PD, Greg Burns and myself all became PD. And I think in a way it was almost a natural progression for two reasons. One, we were a news talk station, so a news director is going to have grounding in news and current affairs.
Yeah.
But secondly, and this is what people probably don't quite understand who are sort of moving towards that direction, running the newsroom at 2UE, you become experts in people management. And the greatest skill that a program director needs to have is people management. That's what it's all about. And
it's also like dealing with pressure, and there's a lot of pressure that goes along with number one, being in a newsroom, number two, directing a newsroom, and all of those things, being able to handle them in a sort of calm manner without sort of losing your shit, and then I guess transferring that to dealing then with egos and presenters and that sort of.
It's quite similar actually, but Burnsy became PD, and then I started, I guess, lobbying him to become news director. And I wasn't necessarily next in line, but I think Lynn Scrivens may have been the deputy at that time, Linny, and she didn't want it, or something happened. And then we sort of thought someone like Derek Peterson, you know, another legend of Sydney Radio News, would be the most senior person to do it. But Derek doesn't want to work in management, didn't want to work in management, so he didn't put his hand up. So I started saying to Burnsy, well, Burnsy, I'd really like to do it, I'd really like to have a crack. And I said to Burnsy, I've got all the journalistic skills that you could want. I've covered all these big stories. I've been your police reporter, your state political reporter, covered these big overseas stories. And Burnsy said, it's got nothing to do with journalism. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's all about people. And he said, you don't have any people management experience. I said, yeah, you're right. But seriously, I'm a good news journalist. He said, it doesn't matter. It's people management. And it's probably the best piece of advice. Well, no, it wasn't even really advice at the time, but that actually is what the job as being a news director and then a program director, it's all about. And it was about, and then I actually did get the job. I'm a bit of a, my career, I tend to be a Stephen Bradbury. I like to think I've deserved positions that I've had, but I work really bloody hard for them. But it tends to be that everyone else around me falls over and I'm the last resort.
Yeah.
And a boss even said that to me once when I became 2UEPD. And anyway, so I Stephen Bradbury did the news director's job. But the job was running a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week operation made up of, at the time, you know, 19 staff, 20 staff, based in Sydney and Canberra. And it was I did it for 6 years, and it was a tough gig.
What was the most satisfying part of that job?
2 UE, while I was news director, and being news director, you're then exposed to the – because you're part of the station executive. And 2UE was quite structured in that way, so I was involved in the management of the station. You become very aware of the station's position. And financially, TUE, you know, it's no hiding it, did it tough for many, many years. And our ratings continued to decline in that period while I was news director. And there are very many reasons for that. I think what I was most proud of is, despite the ratings going down and our resources being stretched and money being ripped out of every aspect of the radio station, including news, I'd like to think we maintained our position as the premium quality radio news service in the country. And that was very much led by the likes of Steve Blander, who just gave the sound of our news such credibility.
That can't be underestimated.
It can't
all.
Be. The sound is so important. But we kept it up with what we were doing as supporting Steve's sound. I think we still maintain quality reporting for all those years. And you know, the people that we then developed and pushed up the ladder, people like, you know, people like Sarah Crabb, Jodie Spears, really good police reporters, you know, the likes of, you know, you've spoken to a few of them, Jess Bellicioni, Laura Tunstall, some good young journos coming through who we started to develop. I'm just really proud of the fact that despite TUE's position in the market, we continued to service a network of dozens and dozens and dozens of stations across the country and provide what I think was a top quality service.
What made them, trying to think of the best way to phrase this, but what do you think the qualities that you had that made them respect you so much? Because as I said before, we made a joke about how they all came in crying when they wanted to resign. They were crying because they ultimately wanted to stay, but they found it difficult.
As me as a boss.
Yeah, yeah. So what thing do you think it is that people respect about you that makes them feel that way?
Sure, Ralph. Probably two things. I like to think I'm quite a hands-on boss in terms of, while I was news director, I was generally reading either a 3 or 6 hour shift. So I wasn't just a guy who would sit in an office telling people what to do. I was doing it with them. So I would be the news reader in drive. And that most news directors like that, to be fair. Although some in our other stations in the state were doing maybe one bulletin a day, I was doing six. So maybe there was then a respect from my staff that they knew I'd come from being a cadet. I'd done the hard yards on mid-dawns. I'd been on the road as a reporter and done reasonably well at it. And then I was then their boss, still doing it. Maybe there was a bit of respect about that. I'd like to think I took on board Burnsy's advice all those years ago that I was a people person. I'd like to think, you know, I think radio people and anyone who works in a business that's 24 hours a day, you work some really tough hours, difficult hours for not a lot of money, to be honest. So I'd like to think that I treat people with that always in my mind, that, you know, it's tough to work on a Saturday night at 3 in the morning when you're 23, all your mates are out on the drink and you're reading news bulletins. Now, I think it's a great job. I'd rather that than collecting the toll on the bridge at 3 in the morning. Not that that happens anymore, but I used to compare it to that. You're lucky. So I think if anything, I've probably had maybe this is not a reputation, but to be honest, I've probably been a bit too easy on staff over the years. I probably could be a lot tougher, but it's not me. I'm not that sort of person. And maybe that's been to my downfall in some ways, in some aspects of my career. Maybe not have been tough enough on people, but I care about how people are coping with life, I guess, you know.
Now, the move from then news director to program director, that came about in a bit of a sort of a whirlwind situation as well. Were you ready for that at that time, given the uncertainty around everything that was going on at 2UE?
Oh, look, yes, I think I was ready for it. I mean, while I was news director, you know, as I was saying with people like Greg Burns and Sandy Aloisi, they developed the skills to be a good PD because they would be good people managers in the end. And in the end, that's critical. But they also had a good understanding of news and current affairs. There was something that I'd done a lot more of than either Sandy or Burnsy, is while I was news director, I was then spending a lot of time in my downtime as an on-air presenter. So I'd started being a fill-in presenter. That was firstly under Sandy and then Burnsy. So as well as doing all my normal news duties, I'd do weekend mid-dawns on air. So I'd be at work all day and then pull a midnight to dawn shift on air and night shifts and different weekend things, and started to build that. So when the opportunity came up, Pete Brennan was leaving the company, I'd already had a fair bit of experience under my belt. Even though primarily I was a news guy, I had a fair bit of experience as a program guy on top of my natural interest in radio. And so, yeah, I put my hand up to be program director. And at the time, you know, mergers with 2GB were long into the future. This was, again, about a new two-year to challenge 2GB. And I became PD. It's always a rough time being program director of 2UE when you're up against what we've been up against, because 2GB is just such a powerhouse. And we were looking at yet another lineup change. And a guy by the name of Clark Forbes, again, someone I've got lots of respect for, he'd been appointed national program director for the whole network. But essentially he'd been appointed the job of sorting out 2UE because it wasn't rating what they believed was effective. So Clark had started the process of reviewing all the broadcasters on 2UE and had already started the process of bringing some new people in. So I became acting program director to start with. Effectively, it was a three-month trial to see whether I was good enough to do it, and I got the gig. But I'd been appointed PD, and already they decided to move Jason Morrison, who, again, I count as a friend.
I love the fact that you refer to it as PD and not content director, which I think is a complete wank. Program director to me is the guy. You know,
look, I accidentally refer to it as PD because I've grown up in that era of having.
But I love it.
The greatest PD of them all was Breno.
Yeah,
and I always think of Breno as the PD, and then others after him. Officially my title was content director. I've got to make that clear.
Yeah,
I'm not anti the title content director, because it's funny now that we've just reformatted 2UE again. We're actually focusing a lot on the content. It's actually discussed amongst all the staff now is, the content for this, the content for that, because we're talking a lot about website, podcasts, what we're doing on air. So I think it actually is an apt title. I'm so old school.
Old school.
Yeah, I'm quite old school as a radio traditionalist. I still think of myself as a PD. It's one of those things you aspire to in a career to become PD. Mm. But, the changes to UE at that point were already in train when I became PD. So the decision had already been moved to Jason was doing breakfast. And as I said, Jason's someone I've known my whole career back to afters days.
Yeah.
And the decision had been made before I even was on the scene that Jason would move away from Brekkie, and that David Oldfield would move away from mornings. He was moved on to nights, and the biz, you know, changes across the board. Again, more changes on 2UE. And that Dicko would be brought in to do Brekkie. And I was then appointed to be PD with Dicko doing Brekkie.
What was that like?
Oh, well, look, it was trepidation because Dicko doesn't come from a news and current affairs background. And at the time, probably still is, and it was a very left-field appointment. But my attitude was I have to do everything in my power to make it work, everything I could possibly do in my power to make it work. And I did. And look, it didn't work, mind you.
No.
But that actually wasn't Dicko's fault. And that wasn't necessarily the fault of any of us who were involved in trying to develop that program and then that station. That might have been a strategic error. I don't know. But Dicko is actually a champion. He's a legend. Dicko's he's actually one of the nicest media people I've ever come across. But he probably wasn't in the end suited to news talk radio.
Victim of circumstance when considered they were looking at a format change. And
the guys above me, they were looking for what Jason does damn well is actually very similar to what 2GB does. He's obviously not out of place in the 2GB lineup. What Dicko does is completely different to 2GB. And that's where the strategy was. Let's come up with something that's completely different. But it didn't work. And it was no fault of, Dicko tried his hardest and we worked really hard to get that program developed. And at one point I was dropped in. I was in there every morning and basically overseeing it for a time to try to get it working. But it was probably not going to work. You had Dicko not coming from a news background. Dicko's accent was always going to be an issue. But Dicko's actually he's a champion bloke. And in another slot, he may well have worked. And eventually he was moved to afternoons, but then there was another change after that.
What's it like coming into that situation where, like you said, you were after the decisions had made, so you had to make best with what you had in that given circumstance?
Yeah, it was tough because, you know, Jason obviously wasn't happy about moving off breakfast and moving into drive, but he wanted to make it work, wanted to make drive work, and that was tough.
And he had one of the best operators in town, in Brian Carlton, running the show behind the scenes.
Yeah, so, you know, we were looking for a producer and Jason had the idea to bring Spoonie in, and thankfully we got Brian to come on board, which was awesome. But there were lots of different aspects that weren't, you know, brilliant across the whole business, to be honest. You know, Paul Murray, who I've been mates with now for more than a decade, we had him on the morning show. And we tried something different. We based him at the Sydney Morning Herald in a little studio that we built down there. And the idea, again, was to try to utilize the resources of the Sydney Morning Herald. Did it work? Probably not. Now, that's not Paul. That's probably Paul was probably somebody who needed to be around his mates. And in the end, if he had been at 2UE in the 2UE studios, you know, maybe he would have had a bigger chance of success because he would have been cuddled by me and all his mates at UE. But he was just sort of isolated at the Herald. And then he was coming off the back of Dicko's show, which wasn't quite right. Wasn't quite working. So, yeah, it was tough. And so I oversaw that lineup. But then towards the end of that year, again, we did a bit of research, and it was pretty clear, pretty backed up what a few of us thought, that the Dicko and Sarah show, and again, Sarah Morris, somebody I developed in the newsroom who was then appointed co-host, it was decided the Dicko and Sarah show wasn't working and wasn't ever going to work in that slot. So we then reshuffled again. And then that's when we appointed John Stanley to the breakfast show and wanted to find him a co-host. And we went through a few trials to find a co-host. And I'd like to think we were then blessed to discover Gary Linnell, who now does breakfast, still does breakfast, even though we've changed formats. It's the John and Gary Breakfast Show. And I think it is one of the great untapped programs in Australian media. I think it's a brilliant show. And
what makes it work?
Oh, chemistry. Simple chemistry. It's probably what we were looking for with Dicko in the first place. We were looking for something that was different to a standard news and current affairs show, but we went down the path with someone who didn't have news and current affairs background. John Stanley's obviously been in the game forever as a radio journo. Gary Linnell has huge amounts of news credibility as the former editor of the Daily Telegraph, boss of Channel 9 News and Current Affairs, boss of Fairfax Editorial.
He's no one's fool.
No, and he came into it completely green, and it sort of worked. We started doing demos with him. I got him to do a few off-air programs. Then Stanley at the time was doing Saturday and Sunday morning breakfast shows. So we dropped Linnell in there. And we actually trialed a few different co-hosts over the course of about a month. And something just clicked with Stanley, Linnell and Stanley. They just had a chemistry really quickly. And I personally think it's a really good breakfast show. And I think it positions TUE really well because it's completely different to Alan Jones. And there's no point, you know, whatever we're going to do with TUE into the future, or we are now what we're doing, there's no point doing exactly what 2GB do. So there's no point doing a Alan Jones-style breakfast show, but on TUE when the company owns both stations. And John and Gary shows, it's completely different. It works.
Now, rumours of a merger had been around for such a long time. I remember being around the first time that it was touted in 2003. It didn't get off the ground until over a decade.
That was the JV, as it was called, the joint venture,
yes,
whereby 2UE and 2GB would be not merged. They would be separate companies, but they would be supplied services, news, sales, back end.
A prettied up merger.
It's a joint venture. That wouldn't have worked.
It didn't happen at that time, but it certainly happened.
Funny, you know, the merger's been spoken about for so long, and it sounds funny coming from a 2UE traditionalist. I've believed for many years it is the best thing for 2UE. And the simple reason for that is that, sadly, and increasingly so in this more diversified media world, I don't think Sydney can support two commercial news talk stations owned by different operators. 2UE has struggled financially for years. Now, when 2UE was number one and 2GB was number whatever they were, as you know, back in those days, it didn't make money either.
No.
The cycle has gone like that now for decades, where either 2UE or 2GB is on top, and the one that's not on top doesn't make money. And I honestly feared for TUE's future for many years, that eventually an owner would come along for a network and say, well, hang on, TUE, why doesn't it make money? Shut its doors. So I've always seen the merger as the cure for TUE. I'm not saying that as a company man. I'm saying that as a realist, in that 2U's cost base is obviously now much lower than it was even 2 years ago because we now share resources with 2GB. We share a newsroom. We share a sales department. We share a production department, all those things. And I think it was, unfortunately, for 2UE traditionalists who liked the 2GB-2UE rivalry, that I think is missing from the world. I mean, that was a great part of Sydney. But I think in the end, if it didn't happen, there wouldn't be a 2UE. Now, later this week, as we record this, there'll be no more Ford Falcons built in Australia. Holden closes its doors next year. Did we ever think the day those Australian icons would be no more? Well, they are. And there's nothing to say that 2UE would not have gone the same direction.
From your point of view, though, being behind the scenes, there's obviously a whole lot of pain that goes along with that, given the fact that you are such a staunch and proud 2UE person.
Well, the pain's been coming for years, though, in that people often, I reply to virtually every listener complaint I get. So I've been replying to a lot of complaints over the years. Why do listeners complain to talk radio stations? They hate change. Well, sadly, 2UE has changed its presenter lineup continuously for 12 years.
Oh, like you said, it's a reflection of when 2GB was down the bottom, because that used to be the running gag over at the old 2GB used to be, another change in lineup.
Now, I'm not defending those changes. I think if we had stuck with something years ago, it might have worked out better for us. Absolutely. Change doesn't breed success. But also, you've got to look at the financial side of it as well. If you've got programs that are costing you X dollars, but you're only bringing in Y, it's hard to sustain them year after year after year without an owner that's willing to put long-term investment in.
Yeah.
What I hope with 2UE into the future is we now have an owner that has a very successful radio station in Sydney, 2GB, that has successful radio stations interstate like 3AW, and that with a shared cost base, it will allow 2UE to then bed in a lineup for the long term, to then start building audience over a long term and allow it to then be sustainable. That's what I would hope.
It must have also been sad for you to see what happened to the newsroom, given the fact that it had its esteemed history and being part of that. It seems to have come together quite well over the last, 18 months now or close to that. What were your feelings on that? Just removing your management part aside and being a cadet journalist, a police reporter with 2UE, a news director at 2UE, looking at that point of view strictly from news.
Yeah, it was sad, obviously, because even from just the physical side of it, the fact that we weren't broadcasting news bulletins from the Greenwich newsroom where we had been there for 10 years, the microphone, the legendary 2UE microphone, suddenly wasn't seen as much. Although, I must point out that it was still being used up until 3 weeks ago, not as much as the 2GB microphone, I might add. But still, the 2UE logo was still being used. Michael Packey would often use the 2UE microphone.
Who was such a great servant to both stations over such a long period of time.
Pack's just, a legend. It tinged with sadness, but I really am a realist, Ralph. And for people who are we had a lot of redundancies at the time of the merger and so forth. The people who've been left behind have been holding the joint together, wearing three and four hats at once. And this isn't just since merger. Since we started losing money year after year, people left it to UE. When the Mike Carltons have gone and the John Laws have gone, you've had to do multiple roles. And that's been really hard work.
Mm.
And so while from a sentimental part, you don't like to see the end of the 2UE microphone logo, you're also thinking, how long can this go on for, where you're having to work two and three jobs to keep the joint going?
I think also the advent of social media and how people consume their news these days has had an impact on all of that as well.
Of course it has. Whereby when I was covering the Chappelle Corby story, you really needed to be listening to a radio to hear the constant updates of what was happening in the courtroom. These days, people are tweeting it or putting it on Facebook or you're watching it on a website, you're watching it live on Sky. It's just completely different. You can't compare it anymore. Times change and radio stations and formats need to change as well.
I'm a bit of a case in point these days where I'd rarely watch a 6 o'clock news bulletin these days. But, Brian told me for so many years that that's where I would get my news of the day. Well, I've already got all of that news earlier on in the day, so I feel like I'm pretty much up to date already by the time 6 o'clock comes around. And if I need to watch something later, I'll watch it later on. So I think just purely the changing of habits has also had a huge impact on how people approach their news as well.
Everything's different. We never thought we'd see the day that Holden wouldn't make cars in this country. It's changed because consumer tastes have changed, and it's the same with audience taste. Changed.
We never thought we'd see the day the Cronulla Sharks win a premiership. Talk to me about that. A lifelong Cronulla fan, the last couple of days for you must have been massive.
Yeah. And it's funny, we've changed format of the radio station, so I actually have not spoken about this in any depth on the radio because...
Are you busting?
Well, because, you know, our new format, it's a lifestyle format, and we're now sticking to particular topics each hour. I'm not currently hosting a sports show, so I'm not venting about the Sharks, which is probably a good thing for our listeners, to be honest. Look, you know, Ralph, I'm 40 years of age, and so that means I've been probably going to the football for 35 of those 40 years. And why do you go to a football game? In the end, why do you go to a sporting contest? You go to see a victory eventually, and those victories culminate in a premiership. Now, when you go every 2 weeks to home games and away games for decades, that's a lot of emotional investment looking for that victory. It's a lot of emotional investment, and there's never been the payoff as a Cronulla supporter, ever. And so to go through what we've been through over the last month, the final series, and then Sunday night, it was just... Oh, it was just amazing. You know, the match against the Cowboys 2 weeks ago, the grand final qualified, that was hugely emotional, to be honest. Making the grand final, that was one of the moments, nights of my life. And then, yeah, of course, it was topped on Sunday night at ANZ Stadium, which was just remarkable.
Take me through your day. What was it like? Because I know you're at best, you're a nervous Cronulla supporter, as there are so many. Like my dad is one that has watched, I would say, every game for the entire 50 years that they've been in existence. So I know what it's like to witness.
It's very different to the match the week before. So when we beat the Cowboys, there's a lot of joy and pleasure in that game because we were on top from the opening whistle. And even at halftime, it looked like we were going to win quite easily.
Yeah.
And we switched off with 20 to go. So that was just a celebration of making a grand final. Sunday was different. We had the debate, only a very short debate in my house, about whether we'd take the kids. We've got three little kids.
Yep.
And my wife and I discussed whether we would, because tickets are not cheap.
No, not too much.
And we decided, no, we would, because I didn't want my boys and my girls turning around in 10 years' time when they're teenagers saying, why didn't you take us to the grand final, Dad? Bastard. So we made the decision that the kids, but when you've got we've got 6-year-old twins and an 8-year-old, you know, with little kids, you've got to put a lot of thought into how you manage a long day. I decided we'd try and get a parking spot, so we booked a parking spot so we didn't have to get the train on the way home and have to deal with the kids on a train.
Yep.
And we're pretty strict with our kids. They're all in bed and asleep by 8 o'clock at night every night. So this was going to be, given the kickoff was 7:30, this was going to be a challenge in itself. So, yeah, it started with, you know, preparation at home, and I had to pick out what I was going to wear. That was important to me.
And then, just a 40-year-old guy, not a 14-year-old guy. Yeah. But anyway.
So there it was, we got to the stadium and we took plenty of photos outside the stadium. And then we must have gone in probably at about 4:30. And that was, so, you know, little Nick, who's six, is saying to me, is it starting yet, Daddy? No, it's still 3 hours away. And it was really hot on Sunday and we were in the beating sun. We had these seats behind the goalposts, but just fortunate through Ticket Tech, when I logged on Monday, last Monday, I got tickets in the front row, which was just awesome, and I took them. So not the best view in the world of the game, but to be there, you know, ANZ Stadium doesn't have great atmosphere because usually you're so far away from the action, but to be sitting in the front row next to the field was just once-in-a-lifetime stuff. So there was the build-up and nerves, and this moment where they started showing video of Melbourne Storm and Cronulla Sharks sides over the years, and they showed this vision of Steve Rogers, Greg Pearce and the Sorensen brothers and Brett Camorley and all these legends of Shark sides gone by and DT. I got teary. I got real teary because it just means so much that all those guys, they've been legends of rugby league. They never got a chance to win a premiership. Haven't played in a grand final since 78, 38 years. And it just, you know, I was dealing with it all week, but it was just showed me again the enormity of what we were going to experience that night. And to then, you know what it's like being in the Shire, Ralph, to see, you know, probably conservatively 65,000 Shire people in this one spot outside of the Shire.
Everyone I knew was at the game that night.
It was just, I've never seen so much blue, black and white. And have to go into Shark Park itself for 35 years to see them all there singing up Cronulla and everything before the game was just, you know, it was remarkable. But there was a bit of nervousness, obviously, throughout the game from the whole crowd, to be honest.
Did you think you were cursed midway through that second half?
You know, it got to half time, we're up 8-0. And so, you know, when we scored that try and Ben Barber scored that try, in great seats because it all happened in front of us pretty much the whole game except the Fifita try. Ben Barber crosses the line in front of us. And, you know, I just embraced my little girl who's eight and it just felt on top of the world. It's 8-0 at half time. We were obviously quite dominant in the first half. And John Stanley rings me at half time and says, mate, you got this. Just relax and enjoy the second half.
I saw him at North Cronulla Beach. He was doing a bit for Offsiders on Sunday morning, and he said, these guys have got this.
Yeah.
He was just so convinced. He just looked at me and he just rattled off all the sporting hoodoos that had fallen by the wayside this year. The sporting gods will play on these guys.
He repeated that to me five times before the game. And then, you know, there was a Gus Gould column on Saturday night that said the same. You know, he said, Cronulla Sharks cannot lose the grand final, basically. And Stanley's rung me at halftime. He said, mate, you got this. Just enjoy the second half. You're so dominant. And when you're at the game, you can't quite – you don't. And when you're as emotional and tense as I was, I couldn't quite realise that. He said, Joey said it's going to be tough in the first 15. It'll be tight. And then you'll blow them away in the back half of the half. You'll put all these points on. And I said, Stanley, no, we won't. This is Cronulla. This is poised for the greatest disappointment of all time. I could just see it coming. And when the Storm hit the front in the second half, we got to 20 minutes before we were going to win a premiership and it was being taken away from us. And I thought we were gone when Will Chambers scored that try in the second half. I thought
Melbourne were going to strangle the life out of it.
Yeah, I thought that they hit the front 12-8, I think it was at the time. We're gone. And obviously then when Fifita scored with 10 to go at the other end of the foot where I was, and it was in front of the post. Maloney was going to kick the goal, 14-12, wow. But then we've got to hang on for 10 minutes, longest 10 minutes of my life. Longest 10 minutes in my life.
What about the last minute?
That was just ridiculous. And again, we were just blessed. So many funny things happened around this game of football. It was all happening right in front of me. You know, when Will Chambers didn't pass to Cooper Cronk, that was in front of where we were. Right at the end where Latelli made that tackle, that was again in front of where we were. It was just extraordinary. And the hooter went and finally we tackled them. And I've just slumped over the fence just in, oh my God. I've looked at my wife. We've done it. And then one of the most extraordinary things to ever happen to me in my life occurred. I see Jack Bird running. He jumps over an advertising hoarding and he bolts towards me. This is the rookie of the year from last year, State of Origin player. Jack Bird is running towards me. I mean, what's going on here? So I put my arms out and Jack Bird puts his arms out and then we cuddle. And it was just, I'm waving a Sharks flag and we cuddle. And it's just, anyway, I'm cuddling Jack Bird. We've just won the grand final. I felt part of it.
Yeah.
And then it finishes. Then I noticed that all my kids are crying and my wife's almost in tears. They've been crushed by a crowd crushed behind me. They'd fallen, I shouldn't laugh. They'd fallen down and I'm in trouble because I haven't protected them.
Oh, because you're hugging Jack Bird.
Jack Bird. Anyway, so, you know, we're enjoying. But, yeah, we gave the kids some jats and they perked up and it was all fine. Anyway, we're then experiencing the emotion of a grand final. We're singing up Cronulla, taking 1,000 photos, enjoying the whole thing. Lap of honour in front of us. Took a selfie with Jack Bird later on. We're then walking away. Anyway, my phone is getting thousands of text messages. All these messages. You've gone viral, Maynard. There's these photos of you and
Jack Bird.
All over the internet because it was on TV. It was apparently Channel 9 had captured. I haven't seen it on 9 yet, but apparently Channel 9 had captured the moment. Ben Fordham, 2GB, he's tweeted me. Look at this video, and he's played this video of Jack Bird hugging me.
Doesn't look like you're hugging him. It looks like you've brought him down in one of the greatest tackles of all time.
Yeah, this is nice. Oh, look, it was just one of those moments, the Sharks grand final, and as you are, you know, I've considered Glenn Wheeler a mate for many years. And I said before the grand final, like, I'm not a religious bloke or anything like that. And I said, you know what, there's something weird about this year with Cronulla. You know, Glenn gets out of hospital at the end of last year, and I worked with Glenn as the ground, and we were both the ground announcers at the Sharks for a few years. And I don't know, there's just something special about this that it was going to happen for so Glenn could see that, and then to see Gow and Flannoy take the trophy to him during the week. And
how amazing was that?
Yeah, it's just, you know, I haven't seen Glenn much since what happened, but I have had a conversation with him, and, you know, we're all emotional about those who know him, and just something special, you know, something special.
It was meant to be.
Maybe it was, you know.
We'll wrap things up in a sec. You've been very, very generous with your time today, but as is the case on all of these podcasts, I'd like to get some advice from you for anyone looking to break into media. I mean, you've done it from the bottom up. You've made it all the way through those progressions to the point where you're the guy that hires and fires.
Well, I was.
Yeah, well, was. What is
and
it?
And to be honest, so you know, I've sort of changed my position. Very happy to change my position at the moment. I'm taking a step back from management, which I love.
But what is it that you would say to somebody that you've mentioned it several times throughout this interview, the changing course of media and the fragmentation and all of that kind of thing, which you can look at it two ways. You know, it might be easier to break in given the fact that there are, you know, splintered opportunities within media companies to get a start, but it's not going to be what it was when we were coming through. So what would you say to somebody that's listening to this that's got their heart set on a media career?
You need to have the attitude that you will do anything to get there. And I don't mean backstab. I mean you will do any hours that are asked of you, that you will seize any opportunity that you have. And I'll just give one small example of what I've done in my career. When I started doing on-air programs, presenting programs, I was still working in the 2UN newsroom. And I would do a full day in the 2UN newsroom as the boss and as the newsreader, and then I would do a midnight to dawn show. So I would be at 2UE for literally 22 hours straight without a rest. Now, OHS wise, probably not too wise, particularly when I was driving home. But I did that for several years, not every weekend, but as a filling guy. And I did it because if there was an opportunity to get myself on air to do a gig, I was going to take it. But I wasn't going to let my other job suffer as a result, because I didn't want people saying, oh, you're putting more effort into that than your main job. But I think it's an example that if you're given an opportunity, take it, put the hours in that are necessary. And, you know, I think that's probably why I've been asked to do things on and on throughout different parts of my career, because I've always been willing to do it. And, you know, it's the same as what's happening now with 2UE. You know, I'm now working weekends. That's not the perfect situation for a father of three, but I see it as an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity to make things work. So, you know, just grab every opportunity you can. Don't worry about the money, particularly when you're young. Money can come down the track. Be willing to do anything.
Clinton Maynard, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Ralph.
There he is, Clinton Maynard from 2UE. If you really enjoyed my chat today with Clinton, please let him know by sending him a tweet. He's at Clint Maynard 2UE. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is at MediaMatesAU, and check out the Facebook page. Most importantly, if you could subscribe in iTunes, that'd be great. It means you won't miss an episode. While you're there, please leave a rating or review. That way more people will learn about the show. Until next time, I'm Ralph Tucker, and this has been the Media Mates Podcast.
Media Mates Podcast.